Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement today by Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu that he was exposing Iran's secret nuclear weapons program contained in 55,000 documents secretly obtained by Israeli intelligence. With President Trump quickly claiming Netanyahu's revelations prove him 100% right, and with the new Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, calling Iran the greatest sponsor of terrorism in the world, we'll analyze what appears to be an orchestrated campaign ahead of an expected U.S. pullout of the P5+1 Iran agreement by Trump on May the 12th. Mansour Farang, a professor of international relations at Bennington College, who resigned as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations and is the author of The U.S. Press in Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference, joins us. We will discuss what appears to be an impending collision between Iran and Israel over Syria, where a number of bases were struck by missiles and Iranian personnel were killed on Sunday night. We will assess the extent to which both the right-wing government of Israel and the theocratic regime in Iran feed off each other's propaganda and the possibility that they could stumble into a war that neither wants, which could engulf the region. Then, with Vice President Pence visiting the southern border today and President Trump calling our immigration laws a total disaster, we will examine the plight of immigrants from a caravan of 1,500 mostly El Salvadoran refugees who have crossed through Mexico and have now dwindled to about 300 and are now arriving in Tijuana, showing up at the San Ysidro port of entry claiming political asylum. May Nye, a professor of history at Columbia University and the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America, joins us to discuss how Trump has threatened to close down the country if he did not get his border wall, and that shutting the door on those claiming political asylum is a form of cruel theater meant to rile up Trump's nativist base and distract Americans from his ruinous presidency. Then finally, we will speak with a 28-year veteran of Congress, Mike Lofgren, who was a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees and is the author of The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. He joins us to discuss his article at the Washington Monthly, The Deep State Strikes Back, Against Torture, Why Generals Oppose the Nomination of Gina Haspel as CIA Director, and how Trump is force-feeding the deep state while conning his followers into believing the deep state is out to get him. And joining us now is Mansour Farang, who is a professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release its U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish-American War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press and Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mansour Farang. So what do you make of Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu holding a press conference today to announce that Iran has been secretly pursuing nuclear weapons and holding back a cache of documents, 100,000 secret files, which I imagine somehow ended up in the hands of Israeli intelligence? Is this really the bombshell that Netanyahu appears to have wanted to drop? It certainly has President Trump quickly claiming Netanyahu's revelations prove him 100% right.
There was absolutely nothing new in Netanyahu's presentation. It was simply a show intended first and foremost for Donald Trump and also for domestic purposes, as well as appeal to general public. Otherwise, the International Atomic Energy Agency has issued reports about Iranian nuclear program before 2003, and the information you got from Netanyahu today, everything, every information is very interesting. That even comments on his presentation, I heard both a Republican and also a Democrat, one opposed to the nuclear deal from the very beginning. I'm specifically referring to Khalilzad, who was U.S. ambassador in Iraq and involved in the Bush administration. And he said there was absolutely nothing new in it. I just have to say that when it comes to truth-telling, Netanyahu is in the same league as Donald Trump, so I'm not surprised if Donald Trump is impressed by what he heard.
But there still nevertheless appears to be some kind of orchestrated presentation going on here to set up what is expected to happen on May the 12th, with Trump announcing the U.S. is going to pull out of the P5+1 Iran agreement. Mike Pompeo was in Saudi Arabia, where he called Iran the greatest sponsor of terrorism in the world. And then he went on to Israel, where he told Benjamin Netanyahu, we're both in the fight. So what's the fight?
You see, if the nuclear agreement, that deal has to be separated from the criticism of the Iranian regime in the region. When it comes to Iran's policy in the region, Iran has been helping Bashar Assad, perhaps the most criminal ruler in the modern history of the Middle East. Iran is also involved in Iraq, in Lebanon, wants to recreate kind of Hezbollah in various, in number of Arab countries and all that. So Iran has become a player. In other words, American invasion of Iraq in 2003 produced an unintended consequence, which was paving the way for Iran's influence and completely changing power relations and in the Middle East, in the sense that Russia, Turkey, and Iran have become major players in the region. In that sense, Saudi Arabia and Israel definitely feel concerned about Iran's influence in the region. And it should be definitely, it's understandable concern. And the United States is obviously has very close relationship with both countries. So nuclear issue has become an instrument of challenging Iran's influence in the region, while they have nothing to do with each other. It's perfectly legitimate to criticize Iran, particularly with respect to human rights situation inside the country and so forth. But Netanyahu wants to portray Iran as the major threat to Middle Eastern security and kind of separate to try to hide what he is doing himself to the Palestinians, incredible violence against Palestinians and creation of an apartheid state. He wants to distract attention from his own territorial expansionism on the West Bank and the mistreatment of Palestinians. And regrettably, Iran's anti-Israeli propaganda, calling Israel as cancer that has to be removed from the geography of the Middle East and all that, and constantly issuing death to Israel absurdities. That has helped the right-wing people in Israel. Netanyahu and Ayatollah Khamenei are enemies that need each other for their own ambitious objectives in the Middle East region.
And again, I'm speaking with Mansour Farhang, who's a professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when the Khomeini regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release its U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish-American War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press and Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. Well, it's no small irony, surely, Mansour Farhang, that within Iran itself, the very restive population in the cities, the educated and the young, demonstrating against, not so much against Rouhani, but as a result of the release of the state budget a while back, the extent to which the clerics are getting draining all of the treasury and how so much money is going to the Revolutionary Guards and to Hezbollah and to this the Quds Force, etc. And people were demonstrating in Iran against the government spending money on the Palestinians and saying, stop wasting money on the Palestinians, help us. So isn't that an irony?
Exactly. And many of them were arrested and they're in prison, today. The Iranian regime came with the populistic ideology of satisfying the needs and aspirations of the poor. They had a very populistic program. In the position of power after 40 years, class division in Iran has deepened. The difference between rich and poor is worse than it was before the revolution. And unemployment and the population has expanded. In 19, It's 79 at the time of the revolution. Iran had about 35 million people. Today is over 80 million. And today, youth unemployment, about 70% of Iranian people are under 4 years old, and youth unemployment is over 20%. And the regime, incredible, it has nepotism within the regime, corruption within the regime, has reached the point that even in the newspapers and the daily political conversation of Iran, the issue of corruption is constantly discussed. So the regime has failed, and therefore it needs an enemy in order to justify its repression of the people inside and the claims that it has not reached its objectives because of the enemy without. So all autocratic regimes, particularly the kind of totalitarian autocratic regimes that interfere in the private sphere of people, what music they should listen to, what books they should read, how men and women should relate to each other, on and on, these regimes invariably need an enemy. The enemy can change, but the need for enemy doesn't change. So Iran is also using the United States, using Israel, in order to justify its own. Otherwise, Iran really is not an anti-imperialist country in the terms of trying to satisfy the national interest or creating any kind of economic equity inside the country. So the regime has failed, and the demonstrations you referred to was very interesting. It was spontaneous. The vast majority of the people who participated in it were in their 20s, and it was in 80 different towns and cities across the country, without any kind of leadership, any kind of organized direction. It was spontaneous and very dispersed, which really indicated the depth of the dissatisfaction of the Iranian people with the theocracy.
And of course, adding to the irony that the Iranian people are fed up with their government spending money on Hezbollah and on the Palestinians. On top of that, of course, MBS, the boy king in Saudi Arabia, or soon to be king, Mohammed bin Salman, he castigated the Palestinians and told them to shut up and start cooperating on a peace deal, not that there's a peace deal in the offering.
You see, Iran still, you know, the idea of, you know, particularly after the fall of Saddam Hussein and Iran's influence in the region, the idea of exporting the revolution was revived. The revolution, exporting the revolution, died between Khomeini's death or the end of Iran-Iraq war and the fall of Saddam Hussein. But after that, it was revived. So in the region, Iran is the only country that takes anti-Israeli, you know, position, except that anti-Israeli position is not critical, systematic, logical. It's a threat against the existence of Israel. But given the fact that in the Arab world, there is sympathy for the Palestinians. Palestinians are the only human beings, the only population group in the world that do not have national identity. You do not have a passport. So people sympathize with Palestinians, as many people even in the Western world do. But at the same time, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, these countries, or even Iraq and Syria, they're too preoccupied with their own, you know, problems internally, that the idea of supporting the Palestinians doesn't have priority at all. Iran is the only country in the region that its propaganda is constantly directed against to Arab street, and by that, in the name of Islam, in the name of anti-Israel, in order to generate a pro-Iran sentiment, which also threatens their own government. So Iran is using anti-Israeli propaganda for its own attempt to influence the Arab street, but the consequence is fear. The consequence is that the real fear, the threat, is that in confrontation between Israel and the Iran, you know, a mistake, a miscalculation, an accident could lead to a military action by one or the other that it could not easily be contained. And it has happened in history. I do not believe that either Iran or Israel want to get into a military conflict with each other. They have they're using the confrontation for their domestic and regional purposes, but I don't think they want war. And yet, the way they're moving, the way the Israelis, you know, attacking certain Syrian forces, that Iranians have been killed even in the past 2 days. And it's very fascinating that international reports say a number of Iranian officers were killed in the bombing of the day before yesterday, but Iran denies that. Why? Because if they say Israelis hit us, then based on their propaganda, they should retaliate. And definitely they don't want to take any direct military action against Israel because they know what the consequences would be.
Well, there isn't a lot of reporting on what happened on Sunday night. A military airport outside of Aleppo and two bases outside of Hama, one for the 47th Brigade, were struck by missiles that seemed to strike ammunition dumps, particularly where a number of missiles exploded. And apparently it was pretty extraordinary amount of explosions and towns had to be evacuated, etc. No claim of authorship, if you will, of these strikes, but everybody seems to think it is Israel. But some of the Iranian and Syrian authorities said the missiles came from a British base in Jordan. So would that be a way to disguise the origin so that they didn't
exactly,
have to?
Because disguising the origin has a political purpose, definitely for Iran, in the sense that if they say it was Israel and they really suffered the casualties, then based on their propaganda and claim, they should retaliate. And they absolutely do not want to take military action. So they blame someone else or another source in order to divert attention from what actually happened. Otherwise, international reports and also the nature of the attack shows that this is the area that, based on the reports, Iranians are working with the Syrian, you know, army, and it concerns Israel that whether Iran is going to have any kind of military base. The threat may not be immediate, but given the history of Israel and people think about their security, given the suffering of the Jewish people for centuries and centuries, when someone threatens them, threatens to destroy them, it influences people. Otherwise, Iran is the enemy of peace movement in Israel.
Well, you know, we've seen, we haven't seen it for a while, but there was, of course, the famous Barbara Tuchman book, The Guns of August, The March of Folly into World War One. There is a complexity of alliances there in Syria with all these different factions, and then the Russians and the Iranians, Hezbollah, the Israelis, the British, the French, and the Americans, and the Turks, and the Kurds. So it's already a pretty complicated mix. Your point that maybe neither Iran nor Israel wants a war, but surely they're stumbling in that direction, are they not? I mean, as Iran gets closer to the Golan Heights, and if these Arab militias, Shia militias in Iraq that they've trained start moving in, apparently that is a red line for the Israelis.
It is a red line. I think here the question is Russian role, as well as Syria itself. Syria, over the past 40, 50 years, Syria has not been at all a threat to Israeli security. So if Iran is going to create some kind of Syrian Hezbollah organization in the Golan Heights area and region, position of Russian and position of Bashar Assad will be very important, that it's going to reach the point or be expanded to the point that it will actually be a threat to Israel, or it's in the early stages of getting help from them in order to create, to strengthen the coercive apparatus of the Syrian military security apparatus, and then ask them to leave. I don't think the Russians want to see a war there. I don't think the Russians are going to let Iran to have a major military force in the Golan Heights region.
Well, Mansour Farang, I thank you very much for joining us. And
thank you very much. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mansour Farang, who is a professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release its U.S. hostages. And his books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish-American War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press in Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the plight of the mostly El Salvadoran refugees showing up the port of entry at Tijuana claiming political asylum. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mei Nye, who's a professor of history and the Lung Family Professor of Asian American Studies at Columbia University, a legal and political historian interested in questions of immigration, citizenship, and nationalism. She's the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens in the Making of Modern America, The Lucky Ones, One Family, and The Extraordinary Invention of Chinese America. And her forthcoming book is The Chinese Question. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mei Nye.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Mei. And about 50 members of this migrant caravan that's coming up from Central America, mostly from El Salvador, arrived at the border at Tijuana, and they were turned away at the port of entry in San Ysidro. And in total, I believe there's, even though there was, a 1,000 or so initially set off from Mexico's southern border, it's dwindled down to about 300 at this point. And yet the President of the United States at a rally on Saturday said that this horde could close down the country. So, and today he's calling for his border wall. So obviously that's a pretty extraordinary exaggeration, is it not?
Well, absolutely. And the whole thing is, I think, at one level, very sad, because these are people who are fleeing violence and many years of violence and civil unrest and now gang-related violence in El Salvador. And, you know, people who show up at our borders and ask for asylum have the right to a hearing. So by turning them away, by not receiving them as asylum seekers, I believe the Border Patrol is not acting lawfully, although I'm not a lawyer, so don't quote me on that. but the point about asylum is that people who are fleeing from persecution, if they present themselves to an immigration officer, they are supposed to be accepted. There's supposed to be an intake, or they're supposed to be scheduled for an asylum hearing. That's the normal process. And these are mostly women and children, and some men who are also fleeing from the violence in El Salvador. I think at one level this is a kind of performance kind of politics, both on the part of the administration certainly, but also on the part of the migrants themselves. And I think it's a commentary on how desperate things have become, that people now not only seek entry through lawful means, right, by asking for asylum, but also by appealing to the American public through these dramatic, you know, this dramatic caravan, or, you know, this journey to the border. And I think we have a lot to learn from that, as well as the politics of performance that's being engaged by the administration, which is one of hyperbole, fear-mongering, racist exaggeration, etc.
So is there, have you ever heard of any discussion about the causes of the instability in these countries and why people flee for their lives, particularly young people? It's no small irony that the main gangs down in El Salvador actually were created here in Los Angeles.
That's right. In the 1980s
during the civil war in El Salvador. But in general, what never enters the discussion is there anything that can be done to make these countries more livable for these young people so that they don't have to take this hazardous and dangerous journey through Mexico to the U.S. border and at this point be stopped?
You know, ever since the Cold War, the United States has practiced a double policy towards refugees and asylum seekers. It has always welcomed people fleeing from communist countries. Well, we hardly have any of those left anymore. But it was always very unfriendly to people fleeing from right-wing dictatorships that were, in fact, allies of the United States. So El Salvador is a case in point. The United States backed a right-wing dictatorship in a very violent civil war that went on for many years. And so, you know, in many ways, the United States is responsible for the impoverishment and the lack of democracy in many countries in the Southern Hemisphere. At the same time, Ian, you know, I don't know if the United States, it's the United States' role to fix all these problems. You know, it could stop interfering, that's for certain. But the United States also, you know, when it gets into the business of regime change, we've seen this in Iraq, we see this now in the Middle East, not a lot good comes of that either.
Well, specifically, the regime change in Iraq has led to instability throughout that region. And if you have massive, I think almost a third or not a half of the population of Syria now made refugees, millions have already gone into Europe shortly after the Russians arrived in Syria. And there is a possibility of millions more as the Assad regime closes in on the last holdout of the rebellion in Idlib province. And then, of course, by removing Gaddafi, now you have a completely lawless country in Libya where African migrants from Africa are now streaming across the Mediterranean, many of them drowning on their way. And then we learn that we're actually, the Europeans are actually in secret alliance with the incredibly repressive regime in Sudan, who are quite brutal towards African or immigrants coming from the south into Europe. So,
right. Another example we can point to in the news today is South Korea and North Korea. If the United States had not intervened and continued to occupy South Korea, I think the Korean people would have worked out their own differences a long time ago. There are real differences. There were and are real differences, but I'm not sure that without foreign interference, it would have taken, 60 plus, almost 70 years for them to say, well, let's talk.
Well, that may be one of the few bright spots, although there's a lot of skepticism about whether or not Donald Trump cares about the details of any deal as long as he looks good. So one
Right, of course.
Yeah. So you have to hold your breath on that one.
Right.
But again, I'm speaking with May Nair, who's a professor of history and the Lung Family Professor of Asian American Studies at Columbia University, a legal and political historian interested in questions of immigration, citizenship, and nationalism. She is the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America, The Lucky Ones, One Family, and the Extraordinary Invention of Chinese America. And her forthcoming book is The Chinese Question. So you mentioned earlier that quite often there are a lot of women and children in this caravan, which of course is being exaggerated as an invasion by Donald Trump, who's talking about, I mean, some of the charges that he's made about what's going on with these immigrants coming up. You know, one, he said that they could close down the country, but also at this rally on Saturday, he said, one of the reasons Democrats support immigrants and sanctuary cities is because the Democrats actually feel, and they are probably right, that all of these people pouring across are going to vote for Democrats, not for Republicans. I mean, on the surface, that's an absurd statement. I mean, how long does it take to even get citizenship? or get a green card and then become a citizen if you come.
Right. It takes, well, once you have a green card, it takes 5 years to become a citizen.
Right.
But you know, that is what they're afraid of. I mean, that's why they're against not only undocumented migration, they're against refugees and asylees, but they're also against legal immigration. Because immigrants nowadays are more likely to vote for Democratic than Republicans. And there's a good reason for that.
Well,
because
he's insulted
Republicans are a party of nativists.
Right, but Trump has gone out of his way. I mean, George W. Bush, to be fair, Jorge Bush, remember, he made commercials in Spanish. He was actually got a big chunk of the Latino vote in this country. I think he got 40% or something. And then Romney got right. about 12% because he talked about self-deportation. But Donald Trump has started right out of the gate saying that Mexicans were rapists and murderers.
Right. That was the first that was the first speech he made, I believe, when he announced candidacy.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
So that may be a contributing factor. That would be right. a wild guess on my part. So, but just to touch on the women and children, though, there were recent reports of children being separated from their parents. What's going on there? That just seems so wrong.
Separated by whom?
I believe they're being separated by Border Patrol. The children were taken away from their parents in a recent influx.
Well, there was, going back several years, quite a large number of women and children who came from Central America and who asked for asylum when they entered the United States. And there were also a number of children or minors who came without any adults. They were called unaccompanied minors. And they're held in detention facilities near the border in very, very bad conditions as they await processing. So I think, you know, we have a whole system that is just really based on inhumane treatment of people. You know, to think that women with small children or with children who are, you know, under 14 years of age or any kind of threat to this country is just ludicrous on the face of it. So they don't care about children who are black and brown. It's the short end of it, I think.
According to the New York Times, more than 700 children have been taken from adults claiming to be their parents since October, and that includes more than 100 children under the age of 14. And that just seems so wrong, separating kids from their parents.
Oh, it's absolutely wrong. And what is the rationale for that?
Well, apparently for months now, members of Congress have been demanding answers from the administration about how many families are being separated as they are processed at these various border crossings along the southwest border, in part because the Trump administration has said that it was considering taking children from their parents as a way to deter migrants from coming here. So that may well be what's going on.
Well, their cruelty seems to be boundless. It's just shocking and really outrageous. And I hope that this caravan has brought attention to the problem, and it's certainly prompted the administration to make outrageous statements, which, you know, are baldly racist and willfully ignorant of the laws, our immigration and asylum laws in this country.
So what's going to happen with all of these people that were turned away at San Ysidro back into Tijuana? But many of them are literally camping on the doorstep of the immigration building there, which I guess is where they would process asylum claims. And, of course, of the 1,500 or so that set out from Central America, there's apparently about 300
right.
in the pipeline.
Right.
So presumably there'll be about 300 people converging on this building. Has the Trump administration literally stopped asylum? Or is it still on the books, in other words, that you can claim?
It's on the books, but, you know, I mean, we've been hearing reports for quite a while now that they don't take asylum requests from Mexicans seriously. You know, they're supposed to, anybody who presents himself or herself to an immigration officer and says, I want to apply for asylum, they have to process that person. And the news that we get from the border area is that they just routinely refuse to process anybody from Mexico. I mean, they could be fleeing the drug wars, right? They could be fleeing, you know, all kinds of situations. They're not, we should not assume that they are, quote unquote, merely economic migrants. That was the line they used to refuse asylum to people from Haiti. They said they were not fleeing persecution, even though they were fleeing the Duvalier regime and other iterations of the dictatorship. They said they were merely economic migrants. So in many parts of the world, these are things that you can't really separate that clearly. So asylum operates by a different set of rules. It's stricter in that there has to be a reasonable fear that if they return to their home country, they will be persecuted on account of their religion or ideology or gender, etc. So it's a more complicated process. But the point here is that if they present, you know, the law says if they present themselves to an immigration officer, they're supposed to be able to make a claim. So it's not that we don't have it on the books. It's just that it's not practiced in an even-handed way, in an impartial way. You know, until President Obama restored diplomatic relations with Cuba, Cuban refugees had the most direct route to asylum. The rule was if you touched U.S. soil, you were in. They assumed if you're Cuban and you touched American soil, you were granted asylum. Right? So this is obviously a very politically biased implementation of a law that is supposed to be much more neutral in terms of, you know, what it means to be fleeing from repressive regime.
And, of course, that contrasts with the Haitians that you mentioned from nearby Caribbean island who
exactly
aren't treated the same way. So at this point, the Homeland Security Secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen, is more or less suggesting that this is all people are being coached and this is some kind of form of theater. And she said on Wednesday, "We will enforce the immigration laws as set forth by Congress. If you enter our country illegally, you have broken the law and will be referred to for prosecution. If you make a false immigration claim, you have broken the law and will be referred for prosecution. If you assist or coach an individual in making a false immigration claim, you have broken the law and will be referred for prosecution." So there's this kind of notion that all this is happening because a bunch of activists are coaching people to take this long journey, a dangerous journey through Mexico to the border, to gin up some kind of form of political theater. That seems to be how the administration is dealing with it.
Well, that's absolutely correct, and it's ridiculous. I mean, there is an element of theater, quote-unquote, if you want to use that word. It's, I think, unprecedented that you would have such a large number of people traveling together and announce in advance their intention to request asylum. It doesn't alter in any way the fact that they may have entirely legitimate claims, and the only way you will know if they have a legitimate claim is to process them, right? You cannot decide before you've spoken to anybody or had a hearing that they have no claim or that they're lying or that they've been coached. So this is just, I think, more tough talk on the part of the administration. And it's really sad because statistically there might be a couple of people in there who are making false claims. But I think on the whole, you know, they're coming from an area of Central America that is rife with violence and people are terrorized and they need to get out of that situation. So that's the part that the administration doesn't want to talk about.
And just in closing, of course, Vice President Mike Pence is down on the border at Calexico today as a part of this theater, I guess, to rile up the base of Trump's supporters who are told that all of these Latinos are coming up to take their jobs away. And I mean, it's just, well,
that's the real political theater that's going on. I mean, if the word theater is to suggest fiction, mm-hmm, right, and not something true, then that's the real theater that's going on, is this ongoing appeal to what they believe is the nativism and racism of their base. You know, he goes somewhere and they all start chanting, "Build the wall." I mean, this is the real theater that's going on. And you know what? Every time this happens, you know, I just have to wonder if Robert Mueller is getting closer, because a lot of this is also a theater of distraction.
Well, Maina, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Lovely talking to you, Ian.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Maina, who's a professor of history and the Lung family professor of Asian American Studies at Columbia University, a legal and political historian interested in questions of immigration, citizenship, and nationalism. She's the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America, The Lucky Ones, One Family, and the Extraordinary Invention of Chinese America. And her forthcoming book is The Chinese Question. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Trump is force-feeding the deep state while claiming the deep state is out to get him.
Loving you is easy. I can do it in my sleep. I dream of you so often. It's like you never leave. But you've gone below the border with the nightmare in. I'm sending the coyote to bring you back to me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at the Washington Monthly, The Deep State Strikes Back Against Torture, Why Generals Oppose the Nomination of Gina Haspel as CIA Director. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Lofgren.
Good to be here, Ian.
Well, Mark, I wanted to obviously talk to you about the article and the fact that 109 retired generals and admirals have written a letter in opposition to the confirmation of Gina Haspel to head up the CIA. But I wanted to sort of pin down the definition of the deep state, because it means different things to different people. To Donald Trump, it means anybody who's looking into his nefarious past and what he's up to at the moment. And that includes the intelligence communities, the Department of Justice, and the FBI. And a recent Monmouth University poll indicated that 60% of Americans believe there is a deep state, although, again, they are not sure about what that is. And in a vague terms, it sort of means too much government power. So give us your definition.
Well, I wouldn't say it's too much government power per se. It's the sort of illicit connection between government and private industry, such as the military-industrial complex or Wall Street or Silicon Valley, in such a way that it tends to bypass what citizens and voters want. Now, there are certain things about the deep state, shall we say, that are good. Insofar, if you have a continuity of operations, if the FAA inspectors continue to do their job regardless of who's president, if people at the Centers for Disease Control continue to monitor to keep Ebola out of the country and so forth, that's a good thing. It becomes a bad thing when you have, for instance, a revolving door between Wall Street and Washington, whereby big shots from Citigroup or from J.P. Morgan Stanley, or J.P. Morgan Chase, rather, can sort of shuttle in and out of the Treasury Department. And we have this right now with Goldman Sachs and Steve Mnuchin. So definitely, Donald Trump is not an opponent of the deep state. He's got a billionaire's cabinet that makes Bush's cabinet look like a bunch of pikers.
Well, we have the biggest defense budgets in history. Trump is pouring more and more money at defense. It's over $700 billion a year now, more than it was at the height of the Cold War. And when it's pretty hard to find any real enemies, and the worst of them, the North Koreans, are about to become friends. So I don't understand how this guy can tell his people, Trump, his followers, that there's a conspiracy of the deep state, when he's the one who's lavishing them. He's feeding the beast.
Well, that's absolutely true with respect to the Department of Defense. He's feeding them so heavily they can barely swallow it. They literally now do not know what to do with the money. But as to the point of why his followers would believe it, I mean, it's even more incredible that his right-wing religious followers believe he's an instrument of God. That's even more ludicrous, yet believe it they do. There was a New York Times article a couple of days ago about how they're gearing up to fight for Trump in the midterms. Of course, you know, they're not heeding the advice that Speaker Paul Ryan gave to the Catholic pastor that he fired the chaplain of the House to stay out of politics. No, they're not staying out of politics.
Well, whose failure is it then not to clarify this and also point out the hypocrisy of these charges, since Fox News and the people inside the Fox bubble that support Trump, this is the sort of core kind of architecture of their beliefs, that there's a deep state conspiracy out to get Donald Trump. Is it the failure of the press? I mean, the press...
It is to some degree a failure of the press. And in some cases, as the old Soviet Union would say, it's a matter of correlation of forces. I'm just one lone author. I don't have the resources and the digital reach of Rupert Murdoch.
Well, I don't. You're in Washington. The White House Correspondents' Dinner, of course, is getting a lot of publicity, and you've got all the kind of lapdogs in the press yapping with indignation about this comedian, who actually, as far as I can tell, spoke the truth. She basically told the Washington Press Corps that you guys helped elect this character, this catastrophe.
Well, you know, perhaps her jokes aren't necessarily to everyone's taste or even to mine. But the point is, what the heck did they expect to get when they hired a comic? Right. And this is supposed to be an event that honors the First Amendment. I've heard on some of the news programs, news people saying, well, this is an event that's supposed to give scholarships and defend the First Amendment. We didn't plan anything like that. Well, that's exactly what the First Amendment is about, unpopular speech, speaking truth to power. And I heard somewhere Andrea Mitchell was saying, that's Mrs. Alan Greenspan, she's married to the former Federal Reserve Board chairman, saying that Ms. Wolf owes Sarah Huckabee an apology. Well, I don't recall her ever saying that Trump owed any of his people that he calumnied, that he attacked, an apology.
So let's turn to Gina Haspel's nomination and try and again figure out where this gels with the Trump base, who believe the deep state is out to get him. Trump himself castigated and attacked the intelligence community because they were the first to tell him about the Steele dossier. He's been going after the FBI and the DOJ and trying to purge them of anybody that is looking into what he's done previously to becoming president and since he's turned over the White House to his family business and is busily making money. So what's going on here? Where does she fit into that kind of paradigm? Is she deep?
Well, it's interesting that he denigrates these career people. You know, he just calls them, you know, bureaucrats of the deep state. But in this case, he chose a career employee of the CIA. Now, he could have chosen among a dozen or more people, but he chose her specifically because she was, because she was entangled both in torture, namely waterboarding, and destruction of evidence that was denied to congressional oversight. And I think he's dog-whistling his loyal followers that, yes, you'll get your heart's desire, you'll get torture, and you'll get no oversight of the government, which they don't want. They really don't want any oversight as long as Trump is in charge.
Well, Trump doesn't want any investigation into himself. I mean, it's extraordinary how this man is behaving as someone who is so manifestly guilty. And he's had some success in purging the FBI and crippling, thanks to his buddy Devin Nunes, the House Intelligence Committee's investigation. So, but for Robert Mueller, there'd be no body really threatening Trump, even though there's been so many books and investigations over the years that the weight of which is so extraordinary that, you know, this guy,
you know,
is a crook.
I didn't mean to give a sort of constitutional law seminar, but I think the sort of hack work that the House Intelligence Committee and certain individuals, Republicans in the House, are doing needs to be explained about the Nunes intelligence so-called report was really a hack job in which they openly admitted things like Donald Jr.'s meeting with the Russians in June of 2016, and all these things, they're all a case of bad judgment, not collusion. They simply label them that and say, therefore, no collusion. Other things we've seen, your listeners may have heard a couple of weeks ago, a number of House Republicans sent a quote-unquote criminal referral to the Department of Justice regarding Comey and Hillary Clinton and the DNC and so forth. And the problem is it has no force and effect whatsoever. And I even looked this up. The Congressional Research Service says that other than ethics committee referrals for member misbehavior that may be criminal to the Justice Department, it's purely a matter of the executive branch. They have total discretion about criminal referrals. In other words, what these House members did has no more force and effect that if you or I wrote a letter to Jeff Sessions.
Well, obviously, everything that's going on with this administration is government by stunt, and Trump's extraordinary ability to use the media to distract the American people from the wholesale theft of this country, by the way, most of which is coming from the plutocratic class, which Donald Trump is not really a member. He's a wannabe plutocrat. I don't think he has anything like the money, and I doubt whether he's ever been a billionaire. But that seems to be the real story here. And certainly all this, you know, indignation about the comedian from the press is a pathetic reminder of how this president, who is full of vituperation and has not been held to account, and people are complaining about a couple of off-color jokes by a comedian when the first thing that came out of candidate Trump's mouth was that the people living next door to us in Mexico are a bunch of murderers and rapists.
Well, I suppose you just have to remember who it is that owns the big corporate media. They're the people who benefit from Trump's tax cuts. Now, they may consider him a parvenu, they may consider him vulgar, he may be a wannabe that's not in their financial league, but as long as the tax cuts are coming to them, they'll hold their nose.
So how does then, in terms of the deep state, where do the Koch brothers, the beneficiaries of this regime, this not just Trump, it's also McConnell and Ryan, almost everything that's been passed by this government into law and all of the rules changes and all of the people in the cabinet are all basically doing the bidding of the Koch brothers. And as you mentioned, all of their fellow plutocrats were rewarded with the tax cut. So isn't that the deep state or the permanent state or the real state? How would you describe them?
Well, you just mentioned the Koch brothers. It's not them. It's also Robert Mercer. It's all the Texas oil billionaires. It's pretty much the predominant number of the top layer of income in this country. It's interesting that one of the three clients, the other one being Sean Hannity, of Michael Cohen, was this Elliot Broidy, for whom Cohen had to pay off a Playboy model. And he was the deputy finance chairman of the Republican Party and also filthy rich. So that sort of shows you the circles that Trump runs in and the kind of ethics and morals they have.
Yeah, but Broidy was paid this playmate $1.6 million. He got her pregnant, and obviously their relationship, she may have had good looks, but I failed to see what was particularly attractive about him except for his money. And by the way, the source of his money is you and I, the taxpayer. He has one of those defense intelligence contracting boondoggles going. You know, he's a beltway bandit.
Well, absolutely. Just as Sean Hannity, the third client of Michael Cohen, gets HUD subsidies in some of his properties. So all these people are basically living off state subsidies, and yet they're the ones talking about rugged individualism and how we have to cut off the undeserving poor.
Well, Mike Lofgren, is there any other note we can end on except, well, I wouldn't say despair, but certainly disgust?
Well, we can only wait and see what happens in November of 2018.
Well, thank you for joining us, Mike Lofgren.
Good to have been here.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at the Washington Monthly, The Deep State Strikes Back Against Torture, Why Generals Oppose the Nomination of Gina Haspel as CIA Director. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.